Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I don't have any comments to read, so what I'd like to do is just jump in and continue my introduction to George Orwell's classic book, 1984. Now, last time we were talking about a comparison between George Orwell and Winston Churchill, and I would like to continue that just a little bit. We did talk about, Winston Churchill. He really did grow up in a tough family situation. His father wouldn't even come to see him when he was sent to boarding school. His mother was a socialite, and she has a dubious past. There's all kinds of speculation about how many lovers she took on, and so he really did grow up in a tough time. But he came out on top. I mean, like this Thomas Ricks says in his book, when you go through a childhood like Winston Churchill, it either devastates you or it propels you forward. And even when his father died, his father was very critical of him. And, he went to a Sandhurst Military Academy, and he had to get in there for two or three tries. His father just berated him for that. But it seems like that when Winston Churchill's father died, that just propelled him forward and was even getting into politics at a very early age. He ran for his first office at 25. Now, he didn't gain that office, but he did come back a few years later and entered Parliament, I think around 27. Now, George Orwell, it's interesting. He also grew up in the British Empire, but his experience was really very different. And, but it shaped him as a man, and it also shaped him, as a writer. And I just wanted to bring up a few things about him. One of the things, if you look at Churchill, he spent his early years in the pursuit of power and prominence. But if you look at Orwell, and remember now, his name was really Eric Blair, Orwell, it's like he was more into idealism. So what he was looking for in his life, he wasn't out to get power and prominence, like Winston Churchill was. And of course, I think Winston Churchill was driven to do that because his father really was against him so much. But Orwell spent his own pursuit in kind of like finding a core theme of life. And essentially what his experience with the British Empire was different is he became detest with the abuse of power. And I think we must see the British Empire. It was definitely a force for good, and it did accomplish much good for the world, even let's say on a quasi spiritual level. I mean, they did really, the British Empire really promoted education, and they used the Bible as the basis of that education. And so a lot of people in the British Empire, in India and in Burma and some of the other countries, they really learned English by reading the English Bible. And so there were many good things, and there were other good things there as well. But, George Orwell did also see maybe a negative side to the British Empire, and nothing is perfect. Certainly, America, is a republic, and it really has this great constitution, but that doesn't mean that every American lives right. And of course, we're suffering that way. And that's, I think, what Orwell saw, or Eric Blair saw. He saw the abuse of power. Now, let me just give you a few facts about him. So the writer that we know today as George Orwell was actually, his name was Eric Blair, as I've said. And he was born in Bengal, India. Now, it's interesting, if you know Winston Churchill, it's like he really felt like he became like the most educated when he was in India. You know, he was in the India and the army. And of course, they had a lot of time on their hands, but he educated himself. And you know, his father, Winston Churchill's father, was so aggravated that he never went on to college or university. But he was really an autodidact. I mean, he educated himself. And we know that our namesake, Herbert W. Armstrong, also educated himself. And it was a much purer education. And Winston Churchill said that he wasn't influenced by, well, let's say maybe the minds and thinking of other men that may have been off in their thinking. He could think things and read things and understand things for himself. And so, but here, George Orwell, or Eric Blair, was born in India. Now, his father was the son of an officer in the Anglo-Indian Army, so their backgrounds are very similar. But he was still kind of more low-ranking bureaucrat in the Indian Civil Service Department. And it's kind of shocking, but they were responsible for overseeing the growing and processing of opium. And, that is a very serious drug. And today we're having so many problems in America because of this, you know, opiate addiction. And Mr. Stephen Fleury is talking, you know, a lot about that just recently on the Trumpet Daily. And here in America, you know, we're advocating, you know, everybody start, you know, smoking, you know, marijuana and getting high. And, you know, CNN, you know, reporters are, you know, having themselves filmed at parties and just telling, you know, everybody should do it. And, you know, the opium that the British Empire, you know, was growing and manufacturing was sent into China. And it was there to get a balance of power in economy and, you know, fair trade and all that. And, boy, it really hurt, you know, a lot of the Chinese people at that time. And so you can see that Winston Churchill, as Thomas Ricks brings out, you know, he was out there, he was out in the public, and Churchill was looking for battles to kind of build his image for politics. And even one of the one of his friends that said the thing that Churchill feared most was getting shot in the mouth. And in some ways, that's kind of funny because then he couldn't talk. But he didn't stay very long in India. And he actually went then to live in Burma as a child. And so, but he didn't stay even in Burma that long. His father stayed behind in Burma, but actually his mother eventually packed him up and his older sister, and they moved back to England. And the thing that is interesting about Orwell is eventually he was also sent to boarding school. And he really had a really tough time in boarding school, just like Winston Churchill did. I'm going to read you a quote from this book by Richt. And here's what he says, and this is the chapter on Orwell the policeman. It says, like Churchill, Orwell saw little of his father, who traveled from Burma to visit his family in 1907 and then moved in with them when he was retired in 1912. This is a quote. I barely saw my father before I was 8, Orwell noted. By that time, the boy had been shipped off to boarding school. The distant figure of Orwell's father appeared to me simply as a gruff-voiced elderly man forever saying, don't. And Rick says, so began Orwell's lifelong skepticism of authority. He goes on to say, young Eric hated his first boarding school, St. Cyprian's in East Sussex. He described it later so vehemently in an essay, such were the joys that the article was not published during his lifetime for fear of libel suits. At 8 years old, you were suddenly taken out of this warm nest and flung into a world of force and fraud and secrecy like a goldfish into a tank full of pike. And that was a quote that Orwell talked about his time at the boarding school. Now, he did have, a problem, a personal problem. Again, a young boy, he had a bedwetting problem. I guess they beat him for doing that. And so, you know, again, Winston Churchill talked about his time at a boarding school where they were beaten. And so, this was a very difficult time period at that time. Now, here's also another interesting quote about his life. And again, remember, this is Eric Blair, this is George Orwell. These are the things that shaped him as a writer. These are the things that gave him the view of the world that he had. So when he was at boarding school, he realized there was something about him, about his attendance there, that was really kind of shocking. So here's what Rick says. He says he also came to realize that he was attending school at a reduced rate, that is, as a scholarship student. This was not an act of charity on part of the school. Rather, his job was to succeed academically and get into a top-level school, Eton or Harrow, and so burnish the lower school's reputation. And so what he realized at an early age is he was actually being used by the school. He was very bright, very intelligent, and they wanted to educate him because they knew he could really excel at his education. Now, Winston Churchill could not do that. I mean, they really think that maybe Winston Churchill had a little bit of a attention deficit problem. He couldn't get through Greek and Latin. You know, he hated math, but he excelled at French and history, you know, and poetry. But here they knew that Orwell was going to be a real success. But just think about that when you realize that well, you're just really being used. Rick goes on to say, he says, one can see the beginning of the adult socialist in the boy's realization that the richer students were never beaten, no matter how they behaved. But it was the poor but clever boys who suffered. Our brains were a gold mine in which the headmaster had sunk money, and the dividends must be squeezed out of us. That was a quote from Orwell. He emerged from the school persuaded of two ugly rules of life, that the strong would always beat the weak, and that any project he attempted would fail. Now, it's interesting that he did actually win the prize or the scholarship, and he did go on to Eton. But instead of actually going on and enrolling in the university, though, he did go and he joined the Indian Imperial Police is what he joined. And so it really is quite interesting what he even learned there at that time. And he went back to Burma, you know, as an adult, and he did see a lot of abuse of power. And here's what Rick says about this. He says, making a poor early impression on his superiors in the police, Orwell was shipped off to a town of Katha at the northern end of the Burmese line and just 80 miles from the Chinese border. It was there, at that remote town on the Irrawaddy River, that he matured, developing the perspective that would shape his writing throughout his career. Consider this closely observed comment from his early essay, and it's called A Hanging. And this is something that he saw and witnessed as, you know, an imperial policeman. And here was a condemned Hindu man, and he was being taken to the gallows. He says once, this is a quote from what he wrote in this essay called A Hanging. He said, once, in spite of the men who gripped him by each shoulder, he stepped aside slightly to avoid a puddle on the path. It is curious, but till that moment, I had never realized what it means to destroy a healthy, conscious man. When I saw the prisoner step aside to avoid the puddle, I saw the mystery, the unspeakable wrongness of cutting a life short when it's in full tide. This man was not dying. He was alive just as we were alive. Now, I don't know what the whole details are. I don't know what the man did or, you know, if he was guilty of a serious crime. But Orwell realized that there seemed to be some injustice there. And so these are the things that shaped his life. Now, just to go through some of this very quickly, there are some, like I said, some earlier essays and books that he wrote. But he did write it's kind of like a memoir called Burmese Days. And again, if Orwell had died, no one would probably even know about some of these books. But because he did not die, and then, you know, his two most famous books are Animal Farm and then 1984, and those are the things that really put him on the map. But essentially, what Orwell experienced was he actually got into the abuse of power himself. And, you know, he saw there was a racist kind of abuse of power in the British Empire over some of the Burmese people. And so he began to see that as, you know, really a kind of a bad thing. And then he got out of that. And essentially what he did then is he became more socialist then. And so what he would do is he did a couple of really kind of crazy things. It's almost very much like the hippie movement, is he would go out and live on the streets in London. He would go out and live with the poor. He would go out to these poor mining towns and, associate with the people. He also spent some time on the streets of Paris, went hungry, went starving. He actually was, his mother's family was very wealthy and they were French. He could have actually lived pretty well. But what he was trying to do, you know, is what most people feel. He was trying to maybe make up for the damage that he created, you know, as an imperial policeman. Maybe he was trying to, you know, shake his lust for power or his abuse of power. And so it really is kind of interesting that his novels are very, very simple and very well written. And here's a quote that he gave himself about writing. You know, Winston Churchill, he gives some really good quotes about writing as well. But we'll talk about that and when we do Winston Churchill's biography. But here's what Orwell said about writing. He says, "I wanted to write enormous naturalistic novels with unhappy endings." And I think when you read 1984, you're going to see that's what he did. He writes an unhappy ending. He says, "Full of detailed descriptions and arresting similes, and also full of purple passages in which words were used partly for the sake of their sound. And in fact, my first completed novel, Burmese Days, which I wrote when I was 30, but projected much earlier, it's rather that kind of a book." And so when you read 1984, you're going to see that he was able to write, you know, arresting similes. And in my literature classes, we talk about arresting images and the way people can write. And an arresting image is something where you take something, to explain something else. And, for example, in one example, a really simple one, one of our more current books today, and we're not going to read this book in the JBL, but the lady is looking out the window in the winter, and she sees these, it's like early spring when you can still have snow, and she sees these crocuses with snow in them, and she compares them to teacups. You know, teacups with snow on top. And so that would be an arresting image. And so I think once you get into the book and then realize it is like a horror story, but there was a method behind writing it. And, what Orwell is doing with 1984, he's wanting to show you the horror of what communism is and what communism does to people. And there are so many people, even in the United States, that they kind of want to get back to socialism, they want to get back to communism. And there's a reality you have to face. Communism isn't good for people. And we even talked about this, you know, going through Moore's Utopia, and the comment I read in the last program, Thomas More really did, he was a favorite of, you know, Karl Marx and, you know, the people that really wanted to form communist governments, because it was very socialistic and very communistic in what Moore was thinking. And so we shouldn't be surprised by that. Well, let's just look briefly now. We have about 6 minutes left. Let's look at a plot overview. And remember that the main character is Winston Smith. And what he is, and if you just think about a little bit of what I've talked about from Orwell, is he's kind of like a low-ranking member of the ruling party in London. But it's in the nation of Oceania. And so we're not like in the British Empire. And again, if you remember back to our very beginning programs, is generally when you have a utopian or a dystopian book, there are things in there that are similar or recognizable. You know, like here there's a city, London, but it's in Oceania. It's not necessarily in the United Kingdom. But, of course, you know that all gives you reference. And it's the same thing. Utopia was an island, but it was shaped differently than the island of England. But it was still the exact same dimensions. And so that's just the way these genres work. But Winston Smith was like this low-ranking member of a ruling party in London. And the thing is everywhere he goes, even into his home, the party watches him through. At that point, remember, Orwell wrote this in 1948. They didn't have the technology that we have today. But everybody is watching him, or the party is watching him through telescreens. And then everywhere he looks, he sees the face of the party seemingly omniscient leader, and it's a figure known only as Big Brother. Now, it's interesting, if you look at Orwell's family history, he only had sisters. He never had a brother. So how he came up with the term Big Brother, I don't know. But I had a big brother, and I had two big brothers. You know, sometimes I felt they watched over me too much. So, and I didn't even, you know, had no idea about 1984 at that time. But the thing is, listeners, when you read this book, the party controls everything in Oceania, even the people's history and language. And so, you know, it's like where's the individual? You know, I have my own history. I don't want a party developing my history. And, even though I've lost a lot of my Western Pennsylvania accent, you know, there for a while, I had a very heavy Pennsylvania accent where tomorrow is tomorrow and the city of Washington, D.C. is Washington, D.C. There's no individual. Everybody has to be the same. Now, as the book opens, the party is enforcing the implementation of an invented language called Newspeak. And again, you're going to see, as you go through this book, you're going to see that these terms have been entered into our culture. And it says, the whole idea behind this invented language of Newspeak, it's there to prevent political rebellion. And so... isn't that what we are seeing today with our political correctness? I mean, it's right there. You can't talk about problems. There's certain problems you just can't bring up. If you bring up, well, let's say a leader makes, you know, a mistake, well, you could be called a racist. You know, if you see problems, maybe in the way females do things, well, then you're anti-feminist. I mean, if you see, you know, mistakes in the black population, well, then you're a racist. Or if you're wanting to solve other problems, well, you know, then you could be considered being, maybe you're a white supremacist, you know. So these are the kind of things that are going on. And really, I look at the novel as really, in some ways, he was writing prophetically. I don't know how. I mean, he wrote this, in like I said, in the 40s. So certainly, things at that time were not as bad as it is today. I mean, I'm talking about in America, but you know, certainly in the communist countries, in communism, and the countries behind the Iron Curtain, this is exactly the way it was. But the book also shows that even thinking rebellious thoughts is illegal, and so there was thought crime, and of course, how did they even know there was thought crime? Well, you were going to have to keep your mouth shut about whatever you were really thinking, or you could get turned into Big Brother. So as the novel opens, you know, Winston, he feels frustrated by all the oppression. He's upset about the rigid control of the party. You know, it does provoke, it prohibits free thought. It controls a person's personal life. Even sexual relations are controlled. Any expression of individuality, the party wants to control it. And the thing is, Winston really dislikes this party so much that he's actually purchased a diary in which to write his own criminal thoughts. And he's also, secretly he becomes a member of the Brotherhood, and it's a mysterious legendary group that works to overthrow the party. Now, he also gets interested in another member of the party who is a female, and her name is O'Brien. So that's all I have today. We're also running out of time, but next time, the 60-plus panel will begin discussing George Orwell's classic 1984. So if you haven't bought the book, you still have time. So remember, we'll be using the Signet Classics Edition. It's available at Amazon.com for about $8 for Prime members. If you're not a Prime member, it's $10 plus shipping, or with the shipping, excuse me. Of course, you can find used copies of the Signet Edition at abebooks.com for about $6. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@peacehug.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature, and remember, you can leave me a message at Facebook. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.